All right, here we are.
Here we are. Welcome back.
Welcome back.
All right, I gotta
Wait,
temper.
hold on.
No,
I'm
I gotta temper
Scott.
down a little
I'm
bit.
Scott.
I'm
Who are
Ollie,
you? Thank you.
and this
Yeah.
is Slice in Between.
I just came from a very contentious meeting, so now he's a little fired up.
And as I said, to Scott, I stuck around in the meeting just to kind of chew someone out. So that was
Yeah.
great. Yeah, and as you said, punching up.
Punching up. Yeah. I
Well, that's
mean,
the way you should punch, right? If you're
yeah,
gonna
for
punch,
sure.
if you're gonna punch, punch up, right?
For sure.
Because, speak truth to power
There you go.
and get in the good trouble. Why not? Like,
There
what
you
other
go.
trouble do you want to get into? If you're gonna get in
Yeah.
trouble, get in the good trouble.
Yeah, bad
Like,
trouble's bad. It's almost like
bad trouble is
it's
bad.
in the definition of good and bad trouble.
Wow.
There you
It's
have it.
right there. That's the episode. All right.
All
Catch you
right.
next time. No.
But no, you're not
I think
getting
I'm
off that easy, people. You gotta
this
listen to a
pump is
lot more
prime.
stupidity before you get to leave this show.
Yes. This pump is prime today, I'll tell you.
All
'Cause
right.
this is this episode.
Tell them what they're in for, Ollie.
I am. I'm going to. So, this was an idea that came up to me this weekend. I was at a conference. I was with friend of the show, Leslie Gates, and as I was at the conference, I just kept hearing those buzzwords, right? The buzzwords from
Buzzwords.
folks.
Yeah.
And I just thought about the words that I hear educators or educational researchers or administrators use that cause my blood to boil. Like those are those words that they throw around, like all of us throw around. And I probably use these words too, and I probably use things that cause other people's blood to boil.
For sure.
But so I was like, let's have an episode about hate. Just the hate episode. So this is the hate episode. These are words, concepts, things in education. Now, I would like us not to do the ivory tower version of this, right? Which
Yeah.
is like, I mean, there's certain, like we've talked about your visceral dislike for PCK.
Yep.
I get that. I get that. But I'm talking, I'll throw it out an example of what I'm
Okay.
talking about, okay? The word fidelity. All right. So
Mm.
this is one this is the one that actually set me off. This is the one where I was
Okay.
like, oh no. Like,
Oh, do not bring that into my house.
well, someone said about like it was a curriculum, person was talking about, the impacts of this curriculum when it was used with fidelity. And this is something I hear administrators talk a lot about. Like, if this thing is done with fidelity, and the reason why it causes such a visceral, reaction with me is it basically is saying, if you give up your own expertise, if you're willing to give up your own professional judgment and follow my lead and do what I tell you, then it's going to work. So it's
Yes.
like you're replace your agency with my authoritarian
Yeah.
on high recommendations.
No, not recommendations.
No, it's not. It's not, you're right.
Correct
I
answers. Correct
correct. Yeah,
answers.
right. So I think that shift to me is like, it's deep. It's like deprofessionalizing. Is that a word? I guess
Yeah,
so. Sure.
sure it is.
Like,
Yeah.
yeah, it's
And you pronounced
it.
it perfectly.
I did. I was a little stutter in there, but
No, you
yeah,
nailed it.
I did.
100%.
Thank you. Yeah. So I think that is one of those words that when I hear it, I like, there's a part of me that just gets a little angry. I
Yeah.
just, I recognize what that does with for teachers, right? I recognize the space and the place that puts them. And I don't like it. I don't like it one bit.
Don't like it one bit.
No, sir. No, I do
I
not.
do not prefer that.
No, I will not eat it here or there. I will not eat it anywhere.
I will not eat it with a fox. I will not eat it in a box.
Yeah, so we can keep going, but I don't think
Yeah,
the listeners
but
out there
no,
came
they
for
Dr.
Seuss.
Seuss references.
Yeah, this is not the Seussical episode.
No,
Yeah.
because
Yeah.
then
So do
we'd
you have
have to
anything that
sing
fits in
too.
that?
Well, I mean, I think I don't want to let go of fidelity quite yet. I mean, I think fidelity is yeah, I mean, I think it has far-reaching implications in what a bad notion it is, right? I mean, fundamentally, it conflicts. I mean, you set it up perfectly in that it conflicts with the sense of who should have the decision-making power, right? So, in the same way that when we talk about science classrooms, we want who has the explanatory power. We want the kids to have the explanatory power. If the teacher is doing all the explaining, nobody's learning in the classroom. So it's the same with all of these things, which is where, you know, like you said, where's the agency? Who gets to make the decisions here about what is the correct way to enact a curriculum? And the implication is that the people who designed it know in some universal way how this curriculum will work in every place, right?
Right.
And that it will work, A, it will work the same, whatever that even means, and B, the way that it works best is if you do it exactly the way that it was written. And that, I think, to both of us, is completely bananas. Like, the whole point of what we talk about in all sorts of things, like culturally relevant pedagogy or any responsive form of teaching, it's fundamentally about, again, it's right in the name, responsiveness, right? That means your curriculum should change based on the students that are in front of you. In the same way that you do formative assessment as a way of understanding where your kids are, and therefore you should be making curricular and pedagogical decisions based on that information. Like, okay, I know my kids are having trouble with this. I'm going to figure out a way to engage them around something related to that. That is the way good teaching happens. It does not happen by just lockstep following some curriculum.
Well, I think as I'm looking at a list of like at least four that I have,
Others. Are we done with Philly?
No. I know I'm just saying, when I look down my list, they all fall into some variation of that right there.
Right. Which doesn't surprise me. Right.
Right. Yeah. It's like, you know, where does power like reside? Yeah. Right. And how does it approach students? How does it position students and teachers with respect to that power?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, something relevant to this recently. So I have a good friend and colleague here at Penn State. His name's Chris Palma. He's an astronomer, and we had a project together for a long time. And he recently was quoting me to somebody else, who's another colleague of mine. But the reason this is relevant is what he was saying. What I had said to him was, if the way that you teach doesn't change based on the people that are in the room with you, then you don't need to be there. Because you can just run a video. You can just, right? Like, the whole point is, if what you're doing is exactly the same, regardless of what students are with you at the time that you're quote unquote teaching, well, you need to really think about what that means. Because if you are not changing anything, if you have a slide deck and you're just running through a slide deck, why are you there? Like, we don't need you there. We, especially these days, we can have somebody who delivers that slide deck better than you on a video, and they can just cue up the video. They can go back and rewatch sections that they don't understand. Like, come on, man, what are we doing here?
Well, I think that's a perfect segue to number two which is, and this happens with teacher candidates, because there are some colleagues of mine who ask for this, but it also happens in districts.
Mm.
Scripted lessons.
Ooh. Yeah.
You know, this comes with curriculum, like curriculum where it's like, this is how you teach this thing. This is the script you have to follow. Mm. And it's like, and talk about deprofessionalizing. This is like it. It's like, we can't trust you to make decisions. We can't even trust you to make decisions about the words you use.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like, oh no.
No.
No. I'm not down for it. I do not want it. No, thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly, Sam, I am. Exactly. The point is, like, if you're going to run a scripted lesson, why do you need a teacher for that?
Yeah, like, exactly.
You don't need to train to be a professional teacher to stand in a room and read from a script. Like, shit. Why, you know? I mean, maybe this.
You're cussing. I mean, look at you. You're cussing now.
Well, the sad thing is, it's like, okay, now are we going to, like, this is the problem to our teacher shortage, is we just have super scripted curriculum that anybody off the street can quote unquote implement in a classroom.
And with fidelity.
Now we've got a, yeah, with fidelity. And now we've got a perfect classroom scenario where we can get people who we're going to radically underpay because they're not prepared to actually teach real teaching. And then we'll give them this hyper scripted curriculum that they can just walk through in a call and response sort of way with their kids, and bada bing, bada boom, schools are fixed.
Yeah, because like, can you imagine like the discourse of the classroom if that's, if it's so, because we've spent episodes talking about like back pocket questions and like, because now you have to be responsive to the students and like think about the discourse that you want to do and the discourse moves and all that, and how complicated and hard that is, right? How difficult that is. Like no script is going to follow that. Like
by definition,
unless the response that you're getting from students is so well, like it's a parodied response. Like,
well,
and it's
gotta
have to be
call and response version.
Just call and response. And where is the critical thinking that's happening there? Where's
the thinking? You don't even have to put critical in front of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so that brings up one for me that infuriates me, and we're trying to recapture this term here at Penn State. We've got a faculty member who's really working on that, but classroom management.
Oh, it's not on my list, but it should have been. Ooh, darn straight.
Boy, that is one where, and what really pisses me off is when I hear from former students, and I love you out there if you're listening, but former students or mentors or
I know what you're going to say.
Buildings who are like, these students never had a class in classroom management. Exactly. How do you expect them to do classroom management? They don't know anything about classroom management. Or students come to me and, you know, reply to me after and say, you know, I never had a class in classroom management. Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to explain this to the layman out there who's not a teacher, like, we think, well, classroom management, traditionally, when Ollie and I went through school, classroom management was, what are the rules that you put on the board? How do you punish kids for being out of line? How do you, you know, a guy who wrote sort of the classroom management Bible for when we were around, which was Harry Wong. Do you remember Harry Wong?
Yes. I still have that book.
Yeah,
and
I
yeah, and I lent it to a student.
Ooh.
I did, because they were like, you know, because they were talking about routines, right?
Oh, yeah,
how do you establish routines in your classroom? And I'm like, all right, if that's really your question, here's the resource for you.
Harry Wong will routinize your classroom.
Sure, he will. Yeah. I actually had two copies of it for some reason.
Yeah, of course you did.
And neither, I don't think I purchased either one of them, to be quite honest. Yeah. Great.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that idea of like your job, like, I mean, I hate to go all Foucault, but essentially this is the panopticon. Like, you're in charge of policing the children in your room so that they behave to a certain standard. And if they do not, then they are sanctioned. They are punished in some way or another. Or you reward them, quote unquote, reward them for good behavior, right? Which is still a form of punishment. Alfie Cohn has a great book called Punished by Rewards. If you want to read the opposite side of the punishment coin,
right.
But it, all of that stems from behaviorist notions of the way that you get people to do good work in a learning context. And from my point of view, completely bananas.
That's a cage match I want to see. I want to see the Alfie Cohn, Harry Wong cage match.
Are either of those guys even still alive?
I'm pretty sure Alfie Cohn's still alive.
Okay.
I'm like 90% sure that guy's still alive.
Yeah.
You know?
Probably.
And probably still doing great work. Like, he's still doing stuff that is like making people think, you know?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. But yeah. It's but classroom management is one of those things where, you know, like it's a stand-in. It's sort of like you know, the analog is in parenting, right? Like, okay, well, how do you parent? Well, you could just have a list of rules that you post on the wall in the house. And every time the kid breaks a rule, you say, oh, let's go over here. You broke rule number 3A. And so the punishment for that is that you have to stand in a corner for 15 minutes or until you're not being a pain. Right. But that's not how real parenting works. Like, real parenting doesn't follow rules, and in that kind of way that, well, this is the way you always do it.
So a little
So.
googlage, little googlage. Harry Wong and Alfie Cohn are both alive,
Oh, and
although the
are they
cage
in their
match,
80s?
no, the cage match would be, one-sided because Harry Wong is sitting at 92
Ooh.
and
Hello,
Alfie
Harry.
Cohn is 66,
Oh,
which I was shocked by that.
I am too. He's a
Yeah.
youthful gentleman.
And the book we were talking about was The First Days of School, which was the
Yep.
Harry Wong book, but he also has the
Probably has a
classroom
hundred.
management
Yeah, I bet he
book,
does.
the
Yeah, he
book
does.
called The Classroom Management Book, which I think he wrote at 82.
Sure he did.
But sure. So there you
I
go.
mean,
Yeah.
you know.
Harry
All
Wong.
right. So I put
Alfie Cohn.
classroom management out there, so it's your turn now. What do you got?
Oh, I got one. I
I got one. Pick
this
me.
one is
Pick
going to
me.
take some explaining. All right.
Oh.
The maybe not. I don't know. I think so. Because when I talked to my wife about this last night, I was like, this is going to be on my list. The word remediation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Or remedial, right?
Oh, remedial is even worse, but
Both
remediations, but yeah.
of those words are and you know what? And I when I started thinking about it, I think I've hated these words that both of those words for a really long time. And
How could you not?
the reason why, okay, so first off, it's a deficit mindset. Okay, so let's set that
100%.
aside. We'll set that over there, right? But then what it does is it says it's a comparative thing, which is, I mean, where the deficit comes from, but it says because you haven't learned it yet, that there's something wrong with you. And if we're going to embrace this thing that our students and our learners and all of us develop at different rates and paces and different, then remediation isn't a thing. It's just learning, right? It's just learning. And so remediation is like saying, okay, you as a learner are broken in some ways, and we got to fix you. We're going to send you to the repair shop,
Well, sort of. Yeah, the self-repair shop, where
Right.
what happens is we do the same thing that we did in the regular shop, except we do it slower.
Right.
So you do the same thing all over again. That's what remediation is. So, oh, you
Or.
didn't pass biology? Well, now we're going to give you 2 years of biology where we spread the biology over 2 years, same content, but spread over 2 years, even though you just had a year of it and failed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Super. I
Yes.
mean, talk about character building.
Ugh.
A certain kind of character.
And then we use that term in like everyday language, like it's just okay. Like, oh, that's a we're gonna put them in remedial English. It's like, what? Oh, and they have to take that this summer for remediation. It's like, what?
And then we disguise it. That's the other thing we do is it's like, oh, those are the, that's the special seminar class. It's like, oh, I see.
The summer scholars,
Yeah, it's like a college thing then.
right?
It's like,
That's
so, oh,
exactly.
I see. No, no,
Yes.
no, no. It's not a college thing. We teach it. That's the place where we teach them the same thing all over again, but slower and in smaller words.
Yes. Yeah, that's no bueno.
No bueno.
No. All right,
No.
you got one?
Well, okay. So I think we've talked about this one before, and I use this word sometimes in some contexts, but one that we've talked about on this show before, but is engagement. I do not like
Oh.
engagement. And the main reason I don't like engagement is that it tends to be used essentially as a replacement for fun in a classroom. We've talked about this, the death march with fun sauce, where we
Yeah.
just slather some quote unquote engagement on top of
Lather.
slather that garbage with engagement sauce, and suddenly, oh, we're going to do it on an iPad. We're going to do your multiple choice test on an iPad, and that's going to make it cool and you're going to like it. So yeah, engagement, I don't think it really means much of anything. And I think there are other ways to think about it, things like, intellectual engagement. And to engage in something as a verb, I think that has merit as a word, but I think engagement as a way of describing how students behave in a classroom, I find that disturbing and frustrating and annoying.
Right. I share that. Anytime that somebody uses that word around me, like if any of my students, my grad students or anybody uses that, I go, what do you mean? Like, yeah. What do you mean by that? Like, tell me what you mean by engage.
And how
Like,
do you know? How do you know that they're engaged? Like, they're looking at you because you're, or, you know, like, and then
we're counting clicks. We're counting the clicks with
that's
the NearPod.
Yeah. But even just like the idea that, okay, well, if kids are looking at me when I'm talking, then that means they're engaged, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, really? Because there's lots of kids who will doodle while they're listening, and it actually improves their ability to listen to your terrible lecture that you're forcing them to endure. So
I just was looking at you right now and not really being engaged at all. So
yeah. What? I didn't hear what you said.
That's great. All right. I didn't take the bait. Didn't take the bait.
I'm just paying attention to myself here. Look at me. I'm fancy.
That's funny. All right. My next one is standardized.
Oh. Yep.
You know, again, like, here's the standard. It's the one size fits all. It's saying, here is the thing. And I was, so at this conference, somebody said this, and I'm still working through this.
Yep.
She said, variation is the norm. Mm. And the more that we can accept that, the better we're going to be as a field.
Yep.
And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
I know some of my ed psych friends, you know, would probably bristle at that. And also the, you know, the statistical part of that. There was a stutter there. Yeah. Statistical parts of that. Like, but I think that's what captures my visceral hatred for standardization, mm-hmm. is that it treats them like all of our kids like they're widgets. And the reality is that they're not. Like, there's so much variability, and that's where the expertise of teachers is the most important and most critical. And like, having really creative, thoughtful, intentional teachers who are in there and know their kids, and they know their kids.
Yeah.
That's where like really joyful, you know, learning experiences happen.
Well, and high quality too. I mean, I agree with joyful, but I think it's important to say high quality, right?
No doubt.
I mean, I think, yeah, so that I think the big problem with standardization for me, I mean, there's actually multiples, but one of the big ones for me is it implies, or when people say it, they are intentionally implying fairness.
Yeah.
While it is anathema to fairness, it is exactly the opposite of fairness. It is equality, not equity. We're going to treat everybody the same, and that's fair. And no, if you treat everybody the same, that's racist. That's misogynistic. That's all the isms because the people that make the same rules are usually not the people in power, because by definition, they don't get to make the rules. So when you say we're going to treat everybody the same, we're going to standardize something. Well, you know, this happens now with, you know, clothing and all sorts of stuff, right? It's like, oh, what's a standard size? Well, in fairness, I'm about as average a human being as you can be physically for men, right? So like, I'm sort of medium in everything. So it's easy for me to find clothes. But if you're not medium in everything, you know, like, my wife is a small person, and it's impossible for her to find clothes, right, that fit her, right? And that seems like a trivial example, but it's just another example of how we say, like, oh, well, there is a standard, and essentially, if you don't conform to it, you're the one that's broken, right? It's not that the standard is broken. It's that you're messed up. You're too small. You're too big. You're too short. Your waist is too high. Your waist is too low. You're too dumb. You're too whatever, right? And it's always these, you know, we have decided what is good, and then everybody else is just, who doesn't meet that standard, is by definition not good.
Yeah, imagine if we just made one size of clothing for everybody.
I mean, it'd be fine for me, but everybody else would be screwed.
Well, and we would bristle at that. We would absolutely but I mean, to think that we could do that, like, have the same exam, have the same whatever for all of the students that we work with, it just boggles my mind that someone would think that that's okay. Because in any other environment, we would say, that's not okay. Like, we would never say, like, we're only going to build one kind of house. We're only going to build one kind of car.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like people would go, hold on, you're taking away my personal liberties. You're taking away my freedom. Like what all that? I need to have the, you know, I don't have the, you know, 2.5 kid family. I have this. Well, of course you do.
Yeah.
Because there's no like, there's no like, that's where the variation is the norm, is the part that just, you know, it feels good. It feels good.
Right.
I still need to unpack it a little bit more in my brain, but I'm like where I'm landing so far as I'm thinking she's on to something.
Well, there's another one like that that I've heard said, and I believe I almost understand, but maybe not. Which is, you know, when talking about race and race as a social construct, one of the things that I think is interesting is they say there is more racial diversity within racial groups than across racial groups, right? And so sit with that for a second and think about what that means, right? So that means that if you take all the people who are quote unquote black and look at their racial diversity, there is more diversity within that population than there is if you look at the whole population of human beings. And it takes a while to really think through why that works and why that makes sense. But it's a powerful notion to think about when we think about even standardizing for categories that we recognize, right? Like, oh, we've got this, we're going to standardize in some way around some other category, right? Like race or gender or whatever. It's like, well, you got to be really careful with those categories because those categories are not as clean and well demarcated as you would like, right? So, I think those things, I mean, part of it is that it's just hard for human brains to think about some of that stuff. It's sort of like thinking about the size of the universe or thinking about the age of the earth or something, right? It's like, wow, those things are just hard to get your head around. So the idea of all human population, that seems like, how could it possibly be true that within a racial group there's more diversity? But if you dig deep enough, you can understand, because if you have a bigger sample, you have to have more diversity to have the same proportional amount of diversity. So I mean, sure. It's really fascinating.
It is. All right. You have another one. I added one more after we were talking, but I don't, we don't have to talk about it. Cause you know, if we don't want to, but I have one more.
No, I'm trying to think. I was trying to write them down and I didn't prepare, for the show, which is typical for me.
Well, I have one that I'm sure is going to create. And this was actually a one volunteered by a friend of the show, Leslie Gates.
A friend of the show, Leslie Gates.
And to best practices.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah.
Why does it see? I saw the reaction. What? So what's your
well, so this,
of this?
I don't know if I should start. I feel like.
Sure, really, go ahead.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, so this is a tricky one in some regards because, like, when I think of ambitious science teaching, one of the ways to describe ambitious science teaching is as a group of core practices, right? So this idea of core practices is in teacher education has been around for a while. Pam Grossman mostly, I think, is responsible for coining the term. But I think the difference for me, well, there's lots of differences and nuance to this, but for me, best practice, again, the obvious thing is the value judgment in the first word, right? Which is like, this is the, and there's always a the, typically, I mean, implied or not, the best practice. So I think the problem is practices should be variable. They should be responsive. They should pay attention to the people that you're working with when you're engaged in the practice. And so saying best practice is tricky. Are there principles that can guide practice? Yeah, there are. But is that the same as saying there are best practices? Like this practice always works the best? No, that's bananas.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell for me too. I think, you know, there's other things that are out there. Like, you know, I think about the Hatty stuff, the high impact, you know, those high impact practices or whatever. I don't actually think that's the word he uses, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
Where there's some research base behind them, right? That says, okay, these are things that work, but then you also have to really know what the, when to use those things, because it's not best. It's like conditional. Like you should be like, hey, here are the conditional practices.
or the conditions under which these kinds of practices work.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. And no one ever talks about it like from a conditional standpoint. They always talk about that this is the tool. This is the hammer that you can use in all situations. And if the hammer, if you're not using a hammer today, then you're not using best practices.
Right. Well, and the thing that goes with that too, that is in lots of human behavior stuff is, and if the hammer doesn't work, the problem is you, not the hammer, right?
Yes.
It's not that the practice sucks. It's that you're not using it right. And that goes back to the fidelity thing. It goes back to lots of these things where it's like, oh, well, the reason this is failing is because you suck, not because that thing sucks.
Yeah, I saw you writing. Did you write one down?
I did. I got you. You triggered me for one.
This is the episode of hate. See?
Just getting all the vitriol out of our bodies in one fell swoop. Okay. So here's one I'm sure that pisses you off too, but research-based. That's a research-based practice, or that's a research.
I just said that. Didn't I just say that?
Well,
I said
you didn't say research-based, but you said research. I forget exactly what you said, but you didn't say exactly research-based, but you implied it, and that's what triggered it for me.
Sure.
So yeah, that that idea of, this practice or whatever you want to call it, right? Is research-based. Well, of course, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean for a practice to be research-based? Does that mean there's one study that indicates that there's some efficacy to this practice? Does it mean that there's a whole body of literature over decades of different methods? I mean, what does it mean to be research-based? And almost always it means, here's another one. I'm going to mix it right in here.
I just saw you like your eyes roll back in your head. You're like,
gold standard, right? So in educational research, there's always this like, the gold standard is a randomized controlled trial. It's like, holy cow. Like, get me a couch. I got to lay down and have a whole therapy session about that. But gold standard, right in there with research-based, is just a toxic mix, right? Because it implies not only that only the practices that are quote unquote research-based should be used, A, but B, that there's only one way to do research on things that really counts. Everything else is like, there's a gold standard. And then there's all that other schlock that people do that doesn't really tell us anything, but you can still do that if you want, but it doesn't really count.
It doesn't count. Yeah.
Blech. Blech.
Yeah. Research-based.
Yeah, and gold standard. Weesh.
So we should have a bingo card with, like, we talked about this other times, but if we ever use these, if we use them in our everyday language or use them with an episode, we should have a little like ding 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 or
right.
Yeah.
Right in and we'll give you a nickel.
Yes. That would be fantastic. Cool. Coming out of you're a research one professor, you got the nickels to share.
Yeah, sure.
It's coming out of your budget.
I've been just rolling in nickels lately.
All the nickels.
All the nickels. Well, this is reminds me. Do you remember that scene in The Big Short where he's trying to buy nickels? He's trying to buy like a billion nickels because he's realized that the metal in the nickels is worth more than a nickel. And so he's trying to negotiate with the federal government to buy like a billion nickels or whatever so that he can melt them down and use. It's like, oh my God, people, man, nickels.
Yes. All right. So we covered a lot of hate. A lot of hate there.
Yep.
Yep. Hate. Lots of hate.
Boy.
All right. So we should probably, temper some of that by sharing some joy.
Yeah. Yep. Well, go ahead. You share.
All right. So I watched a movie on the way back on the plane that I've been meaning to watch for a while. Anatomy of a Fall.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No,
so this has been nominated for a bunch of Academy Awards. I think the one that stands out to me is Best Actress. For Sandra Hüller, I think that's the way to pronounce her last name, Sandra Hüller. I think she's German. I think the background, like her background's in, like that she's a German actress. And it's about a trial for this woman's husband. The woman's husband dies, and she's put on trial for the murder.
Right. Yep.
And so she's a writer and he's a writer, and he dies. And you don't
You don't know what
like at
happens.
the beginning of the movie, you don't see what happens. So you don't know, like, did she kill him? Did she not? You know, and most of the movie is spent in the trial, and it involves also their son, who's was lost their ability to see because of an accident. You'll find out like almost immediately that's referenced in the movie, but then you find out a little bit more about how that goes down as you watch the movie. But that plays a pretty pivotal part of the narrative. It is great. It is slow, but the payoff is just how much territory and emotional territory it covers. And she's brilliant in it. She's really brilliant. So from that standpoint, I was happy to, like, I'm keeping track of my Oscar ballot, like, the movies I've seen. I was happy to cross that one off because it was like, and I don't know what's taken me so long. I mean, I guess it was just came to rental recently. It wasn't in theaters that long. And so my daughter saw it like maybe 6 weeks ago or something, but it is great and I recommend it. So definitely
Nice.
check out Anatomy of a Fall with Sandra Hüller. Yeah.
Yeah.
So check it
Cool.
out.
Yeah. That's definitely on my list. I just haven't gotten to it yet. Yeah. I did watch Society of Snow this weekend, so I can't make it my joy because you made it your joy.
But
But
did you enjoy it?
oh yeah. I mean, it's an astonishing movie.
Yeah, just visually, it's like, wow. And
Yeah.
like to think, like I just the practical nature of that, like because I think those people were actually in the snow. They were
Yeah.
actually in the snow, and they were actually losing the weight.
Wow.
And yeah.
That's crazy. Well, I would have loved to see it on the big screen because I'm sure it's even more
Oh
impressive to
yeah.
see on a big screen. But that's not my joy.
Sure.
My joy this week, though, is related to a previous joy that you mentioned that was also a movie that's on the Oscar watch list, which is American Fiction. But I read the book by Percival Everett, which is called Erasure. And it's very good. I haven't seen the movie yet. I'm looking forward to seeing the movie now that I've read the book. But I've been on sort of a Percival Everett kick binge. I don't know what you call it, but I keep finding books of his. And it started with one that I recommended in the past, which is called Dr. No. But Erasure is just like American Fiction. It's about a guy named Thelonious Ellison. They call him Monk. And it's about his life. He's a English professor of literature, and he writes novels. So it's somewhat autobiographical, I imagine, for Percival Everett, that's what he does. But he writes these very highbrow, thoughtful, difficult books to read that don't sell very well, and it's about his life, but specifically around a choice he makes. I think this is not a big reveal because I think it's in the trailers, even for
It
American
is on the
Fiction.
trailer. It's right in the
Yeah.
trailers.
That he, writes this sort of book in black vernacular, that becomes a big hit. And he has to grapple with what that means. But at least in the book, there's a lot about his life circumstance and his, how he's having to grapple with all this. And, while simultaneously having to think about this book that he's written and how does he think about it. And I mean, he's very much it's also just about what does it mean to be a bit of a weird outsider trying to think about what normal means. It's fascinating. And I think, he's pretty typical of academics in this, that he sort of lives a lot in his head and he has difficulty with some of his social relationships, but it's a really well-written book. It's obviously got a lot of built-in commentary about race and how it functions in our society, especially for Black and African American folks. But yeah, it's a really good book. And as far as I can tell, all of his books are really interesting and have these. It's he's sort of gives me the same vibe as Jordan Peele, where it's like you see a Jordan Peele movie like Nope or Get Out or whatever, and it's a great movie, but it's also got all these really embedded important things to think about in it. So which is probably true of lots of good novels, but I really enjoyed Erasure.
Yeah, with you.
Yeah. Cool.
I the way you describe it, it sounds like that was a really good adaptation of the book. The movie was a really good adaptation. So that's
Well, that's
great.
good to hear. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'll put that on my reading list. I'll check that out.
yeah.
Yeah. All right. So it's good that we balanced some of that the hate from this episode
With a little
with
bit of joy.
yeah, but I think it's the hate of the words we use and the connotations. I think the takeaway for me is words matter,
Yeah.
right? They always matter. And the words we use don't just talk about processes, but they also talk about power differentials and the placement and respect and how we communicate equality and equity and all of that in our classrooms. And I think that, that all matters. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, and the main reason it matters is that the words we use frame the work that we do, right? I mean,
Yeah.
it defines how we think about the problems that, this is a linguistic thing, strong Whorfian hypothesis and all, but the language that we use shapes the thinking that we do. And so we have to choose words carefully because they do work in the world, right? They're not just words. They actually create things in the world that can be damaging to people. And so thinking about the words we use is sort of important.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we'll catch you next time.
In between.
We'll see you then.
Bye now.